So what do you want to do? Well, meditate, you know, bolt for the door. I mean, there are options. Oh, okay.
Can we do some chanting?
What? Do some chanting? Yes, we'll do some chanting. And Suzanne?
I would just like to do some gratitudes from me to everybody who's been here, who has suffered with my comings and goings and fallings and droppings and confusion. You know, it's good Dharma practice, is all I can say.
Yeah.
It's been a challenge to be here, but I've been really happy to be here. And I just wanted to thank everybody for participating in that. And, you know, some people have really gone out of their way with generosity, and I really feel so grateful. Thank you to, you know, who you are, so thank you so much. And,
thank you, Suzanne. Did you have your hand up too?
A little more meditation to help me through my day of travel. You're welcome.
That's what I was thinking too. Maybe we start with some meditation. Sometimes when we're about to make a transition of some kind, it can be hard to put down, set aside the past and the future. And just be in the moment, right here. I like that pebble dropped by Suzanne a moment ago with gratitude for everyone here. It's really, really lovely. And I have that same feeling. So maybe this short meditation period can be devoted to mudita. We've had an opportunity to experience so much goodness in one another. Really showing up and looking deeply into the Dhamma. Looking deeply into ourselves. we can really tap into a feeling of gladness, of joy, of appreciation. Like how wonderful it is that a collection of strangers, most of us, can come together and have such conversations. There is so much goodness there. So wherever we find goodness, when we put our attention on that, there's a pleasant feeling that arises. Appreciation for our wish and our experience of being morally upright. Trustworthy. And be in a place where we don't really have to lock any doors. So nice. And to see the reaching into the unexperienced so far, the unknown, taking in the words of the Buddha, his encouragement and confidence, his knowing, deep knowing. I'm finding the comfort in that, and the encouragement. So if there is a certain experience, whether it was this week or some other time in your life, where you really had that sense of gladness for the goodness that you see in yourself or in another, and bring that memory to mind. And notice how that feels, that joy, that maybe it's not an exuberant joy, but it's a kind of a joy that brings a smile. And see if you can really expand that energy throughout the whole front area of your body. From the top of your head to the bottom of your feet, that mudita, appreciative joy. And we can expand that sense to our right side, filling now half of the cylinder that we are sitting in, if you will. Filled with this energy of this beautiful quality of mudita. And then to the back of you, that whole area, top to bottom, stretching out as far as you would like. And also to the left side. Feeling it all around you. This appreciation for yourself, for your own goodness, for everyone in this room, for everyone on this property, for everyone in this state of Massachusetts. And above, I imagine we've had some help from the devas this week. And below, in all directions, every one of us survives based on the kindness of others. On their good qualities. Above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to yourself. And then we can expand that out, abide pervading the all-encompassing world with this heart imbued with mudita, appreciative joy. Abundant, exalted, and immeasurable. And for any part in us that's suffering, we can bring in compassion. And there is that part of the mind that's the wise part, and the part that's struggling sometimes. And bringing up something like appreciative joy is not for the purpose of repressing the struggling part. And bringing up compassion for ourselves and others, karuna, is not for getting lost in the suffering, but in supporting our presence with it. That part of the mind that sees, that part of the mind that knows, that part of the mind that observes, it's there all the time. When we pull away from the feeling, we're no longer awash in it, then that's where we can stand. That part is not struggling. That part is not suffering. That part holds the suffering and observes it and brings healing through its attention, through awareness. And we have that sense of boundless compassion. We can fill the whole area in front of us with that. Karuna. And the second part. And the third. And the fourth, above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, to all as to ourselves. A readiness to help. Kindness, compassion, love for all beings. Above, below, around, and everywhere. And then imbuing the mind to such an extent that it can go out to encompass the entire world. With our wish for the end of suffering and our willingness to help. Pervading the entire world with compassion, abundant, exalted, and immeasurable. And as we feel the compassion for those who are suffering, we also can't help but notice the unskillful actions that occur that often create that suffering. And for that, we come with equanimity, the wisdom that knows that there's always a chance for a living being to change, to stop doing what's harmful, and purify the mind. And equanimity is that beautiful, calm ability to stay even, steady. A real pillar of support for the world. Letting the whole area in front of you flood with that equanimity, upekkha, the wisdom. Likewise, the second area, likewise, the third, likewise, the fourth. Above and below, around and everywhere. And to all as to ourselves. And that intention, I will abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a heart imbued with upekkha, abundant, exalted, and immeasurable. With no trace of hostility or ill will. And with each of these ways of abiding, of being, dwelling, we also have the sense of metta, loving kindness. It's pervasive. It's the ground. And it fills us one quarter at a time. We can be kind and be clear. Be kind and know what's right and what's wrong. Be kind and be compassionate. Be kind and love the goodness in everyone. Be kind and be equanimous and steady. Above, below, around, and everywhere. Really everywhere, and to all as to ourselves, without any limit, without any attachment, without any requirements. Abiding with a heart imbued with loving kindness. F- for all and for ourselves. Abundant, exalted, and immeasurable, with no trace of hostility or ill will. So is there, are there any questions left? Suzanne has a question.
This is a very simple practice question that, once again, I've just never asked. I love practicing with pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. But I don't have a structure that I like for how to use it, and I was wondering if you could offer something. Mm.
I think it's really, you know, you'll find different approaches to working with Vedana, working with pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feeling. And I kind of like to make up my own. And one way to do it is to, when you get settled in meditation and then scan through the body and identify it, the pleasant feeling, wherever you find it. And then on the second pass, you can scan through and recognize any painful feeling. And then a third pass, neutral feeling. And it can be kind of interesting to see how things change and how some feelings can be pleasant one minute and painful the next, or, you know, trying to see what neutral is really like. But I would use, for myself, I would use something simple like that.
I'm curious, the way that you have been trained and the way that you practice meditation, how do you decide, like, I'm going to go for samadhi right now, or like, I'm going to do a body meditation? Hmm. Or it sounds like there's quite an array of meditations to choose from in the way they've been trained.
Yeah, the Buddha gave a lot. There's this really lovely sutta where he teaches his son Rahula quite array of meditation subjects, and he talks a bit about when they're useful. There are three discourses to Rahula in the middle length discourses, and this is the third one, I think. No, maybe just the second one. I think the story is that maybe number 62, something like that. The story is that, as you know, Rahula was the Buddha's son, and he came to live with the Buddha when he was 7, they say. And when he was a teenager, the commentary says he was 18, I believe, the Buddha is going out for alms and Rahula is following him. And he's watching his dad and he's thinking, he's a really good looking man. And I look like him. And the Buddha reads his mind and he stops and he turns around. And he says something to Rahula like, any kind of form, past, present, future, internal, external, gross or subtle, whatever, it's not self. And Rahula says, only form, Bhante? And the Buddha says, no, also feeling, perception, mental activity, and consciousness. So the Buddha turns around and starts walking again, and Rahul is like, yeah, I can't go an alms round after being admonished like this by the Buddha. He went back to his hut and he meditated. So he's sitting there in meditation outside his hut, and Venerable Sariputta comes along, and Venerable Sariputta is really Rahula's teacher. I mean, obviously, the Buddha was everybody's teacher, but the senior monks had, you know, more direct responsibility for students, too. And he tells Rahula to use mindfulness of in and out breathing, anapanasati, meditation, for great fruit and benefit. And then at the end of the day, Rahula gets up from meditation and he goes to see the Buddha. And he asks him, how do you practice mindfulness of in and out breathing for great fruit and benefit? And then the Buddha doesn't tell him right away. Instead, he talks about all these other kinds of meditation. Meditating on the earth. Since I don't have that not phone thing with me, I can't tell you exactly how it went. But meditating on the elements, and then he mentions like what those meditations are good for. You know, and he's really teaching Rahula how to deal with that sense of self. And also how to deal with any other emotions that can come up. I think that's the sutta where someone in our community was asking about how to deal with aversion for people that they were working with at work, and particularly their manager, to having a lot of trouble with this person. And I told them to read this sutta, and they said what they took from it was that the Buddha telling Rahula to meditate like the earth, be like the earth. Like, whatever people throw on it, it doesn't complain. So her take on it is, I have to be like dirt. She went into the meeting with her boss like dirt. And she said, it went great. The whole relationship changed. So you get to see what fits for what. And it's good to have a meditation object or a meditation approach that you can use kind of as your base, which for me is the breath. And I think that's true for a lot of people. I mean, there are some great advantages to using the breath because it's always available, you know. and it's so kind of interesting. In the yoga tradition, there's this idea that the breath is this kind of a layer between the physical and the immaterial or the spiritual. It's like, and inspiration is breathing in, right? So it's like the breath really brings in, and the ties, we'll call it the breath energy. So breath and energy are very closely related. And I think energy is very, you know, useful to work with energy, whether it's through yoga or qigong or tai chi or something, and feel that and learn how to feel energy and how it moves through the system. And it's helpful to develop PT and Sukha and things like that. But that doesn't, it's not everybody's go-to meditation. And some people really prefer walking meditation, or, you know, you find the one. But then when things come up, you can, you know, look for the, through the lexicon of meditation objects that the Buddha offers.
That's great. I'm going to look for that sutta.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, take a look. And of course, the foundations of mindfulness also really, you know, so many different meditation objects there. And you can make use of them as needed.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Is in context with what you were saying to us, after the breath, then you go back to the breath, you are in the thoughts, the narrative, the story, you go to the breath. There is a stage that you go beyond the breath, that in the meditation, oh, you keep going to be aware of the breath.
Let me know if I've understood. When we're using the breath as meditation and the thoughts keep coming and we are, you know, pulling it back, pulling it back, pulling it back, I think we need to do something else if that's kind of an ongoing kind of experience, because it just starts to become a tug of war.
Yeah.
And the place I would look is the other 23 hours a day without meditation, because we need to start to learn how to calm the mind off the cushion. And sometimes people stop listening to the news, or they start to use a mantra on a regular basis throughout the day. You know, like Bhutto, Bhutto. There's one teacher in Thailand that we visited last year who I've heard say on one of his Q&A recordings that thinking is all defilement. Stop thinking. Now, that's, I don't know if I agree completely with that, because I think we do, you know, investigate Dhamma. It's not all defilement, but a lot of it is. And if we can begin to calm the mind in regular, ordinary activities, that will help when you sit down to meditate. Because meditation, it really shouldn't be this constant struggle to bring your mind back to the breath. I mean, that's what we're taught in the beginning, but there needs to be some progression from there. So something that calms the mind, and see what that is. And, you know, sometimes having a routine before you meditate is good. Just like, you know, if you're going to put kids to bed, you have a routine to kind of get them ready for going to sleep. You know, they brush their teeth, they get into their jammies, and you read them a story, and then, you know, hopefully they start to get like, oh yeah, now it's time to go to sleep. It's a cue to the whole system, right? We can train our body and mind to be ready to sit down to meditate. And maybe it's something like going for a walk, listening to some calming music, you know, lighting the candles, you know, like maybe it's reflection, maybe it's an inspirational reading, having a shrine. I don't know where you sit to meditate, but having a shrine with things on it that are inspiring and calming. Incense is good for some people. My allergies can't take it anymore. But, You know, it's like whether it's sound or smell or, you know, just that, you know, bringing the calm, having calming in imagery. And, you know, just really seeing what it is. Can we slow the mind down outside of meditation? And, you know, doing a lot of loving kindness meditation or Brahma Vihara meditation might also help if it really engages the mind. Guided meditations, there are many, many, many available online. Insight Timer is an interesting app that can help with that. But that idea that there's more that can be done besides just trying to bring the breath, bring your mind back to the breath. I hope you find a way. And even if you can't silence the mind completely, if, like Ajahn Chah said, the thoughts are very much in the background and they're not really interesting to us, that's okay too.
I was reading the Middle Link Discourses this morning.
For fun.
And I came across a discourse on wisdom.
On what?
On wisdom.
On
wisdom. If it's helpful, it was Division 3, number 23.
23. On wisdom?
On wisdom.
Okay, thank you.
And so briefly, Sariputta says, birth descended, holy life established. What has been done has been done. There will be no other existence. Mm-hmm. And then the Buddha questions him, they essentially talk about the dependent origination that we were discussing mm-hmm. yesterday. And at the end, the Buddha confirms Sariputta's understanding. And specifically, he says, Sariputta has deeply comprehended the realm of thought. Hmm. And for me, this brings about maybe a more mundane interpretation of rebirth, where Sariputta is no longer engaged in this cycle of getting lost in thought and engaging with the worldly things the way I see myself doing all the time. So I wonder if that interpretation makes sense.
Well, it's certainly, enlightenment can certainly be referred to as being born. Also, when we take up the holy life, it's like a different birth. You can use that. It's not exactly what the Buddha means by rebirth, but it's a very different, you're taking on a very different phase, where this is a new life in a way started, yeah, without any burdens. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of the indications, like, of stream entry too. It really changes a person. Life is different. Yes.
So this, I guess, I admit, is partly just an intellectual question.
What? I'm sorry.
Part. I admit this. Some of this is an intellectual or scholastic question, and you can say maybe some other time. But given our discussions of impermanence and non-self, I mean, I enjoy doing walking meditation around the stupa, And I like the knowledge that there's this dust in there that was once Sariputta. Mm-hmm. And it makes me feel closer to the Dhamma as it was actually spoken.
Yes.
And I assume that's the reason for stupas. But at the same time, I've always wondered, how, you know, it sort of doesn't fit in, and I come from my birth tradition of not marking graves to avoid, you know, worship of the dead. So I've just, it's always been like flipping back and forth. So if you could say, well, and in the Parinibbana Sutta, like everybody's fighting over the Buddha's remains, and it seemed a little like, I wonder, like, what's the deal with this? Doesn't seem to really fit in.
Well, you'll also, I'm sure you've seen in the Parinibbana Sutta that the Buddha describes how they should take care of his remains and that they should build stupas. And he also said that four important places to visit are the place where he was born, got enlightened, gave the first Dhamma discourse, and passed away. And all of this stuff is to inspire us and develop our faith, you know, to really help lift up the mind. And so, yeah, that's working. And it's not worship. It's different from that.
Getting that separated.
The overlay of our cultural conditioning and our previous religious conditioning is good to examine and to not impose it on the Dhamma. And so you already know. You know, it's like, yeah, do those things, take in those sights, sounds, thoughts of the Dhamma being spoken and the Dhamma being realized, and you know, and let that be a source of inspiration for your own realization. No problem.
It's only a genetic problem.
yeah. We all have the, you know, the conditioning that we have to sort through a little bit.
The genetic gifts as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I love the stupa also. On my land, I have three labyrinths.
Oh, labyrinths are fun. Labyrinths. I've been promised one.
And in the middle part of my life, the middle third, I had been gifted and a number of times to be able to visit ancient sites, 6,000-7,000 years old, the old circles, the old stone sites of my Celtic, Druidic, whatever background, and experienced a not knowing that was a knowing, and out of that knowing that was a not knowing, I would make sounds and sing and encounter these stones. Very strange behavior culturally, except that for me, and this is all over the British Isles and also in other countries, south and east, many, many different countries, they called me, I sounded, I will possibly never know how to say this, except I'm trying to say it now. But there was something I felt that, like I was a needle being threaded. Mm-hmm. And something carried through me. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. I think all the experiences, it's good to look at their, you know, how does this support our spiritual awakening? And that experience of something coming through us, like it's good to recognize it and then open the way for the Dhamma to come through us. Because I don't know what transformation or benefit came because of that experience you had, but I do experience the transformation and benefit of the Dhamma coming through. And there can be a lot of times when the Dhamma comes through, and this is what Ajahn Chah wanted for all of his students. Don't plan. Don't prepare. Then it's coming from here, from the head. But just let it flow through you. And then someone will say, so could you repeat that? You know what you said yesterday? Probably not. You know, but anyhow, you know, whatever recollection you have of those experiences, I see if you can tune into the Dhamma and what that's like. Yeah.
So I guess my question is about the integration of multiple faith traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a minister and have a particular faith tradition and know that I spend a lot of time helping people to integrate those. And I have to say I'm struggling most here this week with how to integrate. So I'm totally, you know, empathizing with all my people who I expect to do this. I am struggling a lot with this right now.
Yeah.
And I know that Buddhism, as is the case with Unitarian Universalism, attracts many people with various religious backgrounds. It's generally not their primary religion from birth.
Well, not in the West, yeah. Exactly.
Right. So, you know, I don't know exactly what my question is, but is there this possibility for integration, or are you really expecting people to adopt a very particular Buddhist faith and kind of leave behind the rest?
Somebody asked me one time, I was actually in New Zealand, and I was on my quest to find the place where I wanted to ordain. And this person asked me why I left my savior. And I said, maybe he didn't use that language. He might have said, what caused you to turn away from Jesus? And I said, I haven't. I have no reason to think Jesus isn't in that heaven realm. And that I might have said this before, that a lot of the people I grew up with and family members and so on, I wouldn't be too quick to doubt that they're going to be there too. And for me, there's no conflict. I also accompanied a senior nun I was living with to visit a Catholic girls' school. And one of the nuns greeted us, and she said, "I've been practicing Buddhism for about 4 years, and tell the students there's no conflict." Again, you know, it's helpful that the Buddha didn't require that we pick up beliefs, that we pick up, you know, this is right and everything else is wrong, but that we develop the Dhamma through our experience. And that spiritual experience, like I said, we're all working with the same material. So I think the one way that I integrate it is through the fundamentals of morality and kindness. Those Brahma Viharas, they fit in everywhere, you know, and you know, you can look at, well, what do you think are the differences? And, you know, some of the differences may not be as different as we think. Like I said, rebirth, if you think you could go to heaven, there's rebirth. Maybe you don't, maybe a person doesn't want to think about what might happen after that. Okay. A good friend of mine came to Thailand with me one time, and she and I had been ministry school students together, seminary students together, and she really loved the whole experience of being at the monastery and learning from the monks and all of that. But she said, you know, I'm okay with the impermanent God. That's where I'm at right now, and that's fine. Okay. You know, so I think you can really have integrity with the whole of it. And some of it, some of the early training I got in fundamentalist Christianity, and some of a lot of influence from Calvinism, which can get pretty dark. You know, I had to. I think there was just an incredible reframing from the perspective of interfaith training. And the seminary I went to, the kind of tagline theme was the golden thread that runs through all religions. And I think you're in a good position to carry that and communicate it. And it's very important that we're not antagonistic with one another, particularly about religion. That we really do see the good in what people are doing in religion, and if there's something unwholesome, then we can call that out too. But it will probably be considered unwholesome in every circle. You know, so yeah, no problem.
Following that wonderful question, I would love to hear from you, Rachel. I call myself a Jubu, whatever that means. To me, my practice is more Buddhist than Jewish. But I hold with me this sort of deep sense of being Jewish. And what's happening in the Middle East right now is just torturing me, you know, way differently than it is my friends who are not Jewish. So I'm just curious for your perspective, and I don't know what you've done or what your transition you have or haven't made, and you don't have to share that, but I'm sort of curious about your perspective on the holding of both.
Here I am.
What?
Here I am.
Here you are. That's it. Yeah, I think I hold conflict for some reason about, yeah, it's old family legacy, I think, of where your loyalty is supposed to be or something like that. I'm not sure. But I think sometimes it's the thing that keeps me from more fully engaging. You know, I engage, but I've always got a little hold on, you know, not quite jumped over the line. So, either of you.
I think I just expressed it really well, that there's wholesomeness and unwholesomeness in all the words and actions of humans. And we have to discern.
Yeah, I want to clarify in case I don't remember exactly what I said, but when I said that we bring this overlay from our religion of origin or our cultural conditioning, I was thinking about things like guilt. You know, the kinds of things that have come down, at least in the religion I started out with in this life, that are pretty limiting, kind of discouraging and damning. And I really think that that's good to examine and reframe and free ourselves from. So it's the same thing, that wholesome and unwholesome, but that wasn't intended to say we have to kind of strip off the old religion to take on a new one or change horses or get, you know, like, I was really appreciative when I was in seminary, and that's a, you know, like I said, it was interfaith and Kriya yoga based, and I was going to the monastery a lot and talking with the abbots there, and Ajahn Sumedho would visit and conversations about things, and my son's the monk, right? And no one ever tried to convert me in any way. And it was just so great. You know, I just learn and investigate and blossom. Just a minute. Go ahead.
I just think you just said that all very beautifully. And I appreciate, I'm really inspired by everyone in this room in so many different ways. So I'm really grateful that I've landed here if I don't get to say it to all of you individually. But I'm just reminiscing in my own way, like, which is probably what has ended up bringing me to being here. But this spirit within self and not self, the world beyond, and acknowledging all the many different faiths that exist, the religions that are studied and committed to and shared. And I was raised Roman Catholic. My mother was Jewish. My only living grandparents were Jewish. I found my way into the practice of yoga, studying Hinduism a little bit, coming here, being interested in Buddhism. And fortunately, a commonality has been, like, oral traditions has been, call it breaking bread, you know, whether in communion or conversation or silence, sharing stories, tradition, and whether it was a specific upbringing, faith, spirit, like a really beautiful wholesomeness, which is, I think, from this week, the words virtue and wholesomeness have really just fine-tuned a little bit. Yeah, and I just think, I don't know, it's there's something really, having that, I guess maybe seeing this wider perspective that has existed within my own perspective, and just thinking about all the people and how you, you know, because these are all essentially tools in our personal toolboxes, spiritual toolboxes, our moral compasses, and trusting how they guide us in our relationship and how we connect and thread ourselves, as Molly said really beautifully, but also are threaded by. I just think that's really beautiful, so that's really all I got. But I think a lot with that too is like releasing the, like to have discernment, but also to see bigger than a choosing. And to just arrive and to meet ourselves, meet our spirit, meet people, the world where it is. And I just think to have a sense of foundation and history and story and enrichment in that is really lovely. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I think my thought was very similar to what you just said, but I'm wondering your thoughts on something that something all faith traditions, I would say, or religions share, besides all the ways of being a good person, is spirituality, is a belief that there's something bigger, wider, deeper than just me, whatever that's called in a person's religion.
The mystical experience.
Yeah. You know, there's theistic and non-theistic, but it's this awe of, it's just not about my little lifetime and me.
Yeah. I mean, there's, the Buddhism's non-theistic in that it doesn't assume a creator God. It doesn't assume that God is all-powerful, all-knowing, and everywhere present. However, the Buddha talked to Brahma, which I believe is the same thing as what most religions are looking at as God, and the devas are constantly appearing throughout the suttas, and certainly in my life. And it's in that sense, there's all kinds of theism, but not as, you know, the all-powerful, all-knowing, everywhere present God to be worshipped. And still, you know, for many people, that is an enormous support. And the mystical experience is going to be drawing from the reality of what is. So it's true. There's a...
And for me, in Buddhism, an enormous support for compassion is this idea, this belief in innate Buddhahood, that each person, what your comments or thoughts are about, just the innate Buddhahood within everybody.
The Buddha didn't talk that way. He never said that everybody's going to get enlightened, for example. And he didn't talk about there being, he didn't talk about Buddhahood in individuals or in, you know, innate in human beings. But he did, you know, encourage everyone, and that if you practice, the path, then you can realize the truth. So, you know, it depends on how we want to hold that, I think. Whether or not it's innate, I think sometimes coming from a Judeo-Christian background where it was emphasized quite strongly, in my case, in the tradition I was around, that we are born sinful. That the Buddha didn't say that either. You know, it's conditioning. And whatever you got now, it's from conditioning. And we don't have to think of ourselves as innately anything. And that there's no abiding self, so no innate. Although there is this one passage where he talks about the mind being luminous and the defilements being adventitious. So it kind of can suggest that there is a fundamental luminosity and purity, but that may not be quite the way he meant it. I don't know. I'm not sure it matters. He also says there's no discoverable beginning, so you don't have to really think about how this all came about. Just that it's an incredibly intense cycle that keeps repeating or keeps going. So, I think, you know, what you said about the commonalities, that I still believe that to be true. It's morality and the mystical experience.
I wish to bring into this cauldron my mare, whose name is Mudita. She's a horse.
Uh-huh.
my nightmare and my daymare. Just three.
Do you have a lot of horses, or just?
Just one anymore. She's an old one, and she no longer wants to be ridden by me. She just stopped. I got her all tacked up and said, "Okay, let's go." And she said, The other thing is that when I was in India with a Hindu teacher, with Neem Karoli Baba, he used to tell, I was not there when he did this, but he used to talk to his people and say, "Why are you here? You have Jesus." And the third thing I wish to bring into our soup here is, I went to Dachau. I was brought up as a white bread Protestant insofar as I was given any kind of structure. And I went to Dachau because I had worked so much in Germany and because I knew the stories and who knows the because I had to go there. And I went into the chapel on the, I would say, the charnel ground. It was the, you know, large expanse of concrete, and the dwellings, such as they were already torn down, was just concrete, and chapels to different faiths. And I went into the chapel, the Jewish chapel, which is structured like a chimney. You go down a ramp, and I'd been to the showers, and I'd seen the furnaces, and I had witnessed the wall. And I just fell on my face. And I wanted to do Kaddish. I don't know Kaddish. I wanted deeply to sing Kaddish. And I said, "Ich bin Juden, I am Jewish." And, oh, there's no end there. It's just, from that moment, I have a deep relationship with.
Hmm. And again, where does this connect to your path to awakening? What are you learning?
I'm here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Joe.
In my experience in this search for something that I don't know what is, I found a phrase that helped me a little bit in issues of, especially religion, Abrahamic religions, and the Buddhism. But this phrase, I don't know who wrote, I have a problem with memory, but they say the Buddhism focalizes on suffering. That is the main goal, what we look at this, about this suffering. And the Christianity, for example, focalizing death. How to stop people from dying. And then if you go to the book of Revelation, all these books, is how the last enemy to be destroyed is death. And that is all the process. But the way it is presented for us, the Buddhism, is more related. How we go to stop the suffering. And that helped me. Also to look at that there is something that we really overlap in religions. But overall, it's pathways for some place. Nirvana or heaven, there is a pathways. And they go to the hill. They sometimes overlap. Other times they go in different directions. But we are all going to the top of the hill. And that is the way I try to create this metaphor in my mind to work with these issues. So, I mean, here I study Buddhism. Maybe I want to learn a lot of this because it's, for me it's very important. It's a pathway. I don't need to reject the other. The other is still there. No, I can go, I can visit, I can come back. But the issues is how to enter that. Then the Christians, they have resurrection, have all these theologies. I don't know if it's true or not. It's comforting. Mm-hmm. In the moment of despair, there is no better thing to know that you go to die, you go to resurrect, you go to be someplace level. That comforts you. Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember when I was in a process of coma, I spent like 6 months in UMass, and I was in this, like a tunnel, like a, in the beginning it was like the Turku River, the dry in California. It used to be full of green substance. Yeah, I was really floating there. And in many times I fell in despair because I knew I was dying. Mm-hmm. And I went to, what came in my mind at that time was not any theology I study, any psychology, nothing, absolutely nothing. The only thing that came was my mother. Mm-hmm. I could hear her voice for me not fear. Mm-hmm. And not fear. And this is don't fear that. Yeah. I ask God to comfort me. I never have anything. I ask to see the light in the end of the tunnel. I could not see that light also. So I want to see the light. I'm in the dark tunnel. I could not see the absolute nothing. Did not come, Buddhism did not come, absolute. I just come with two hands support my head. And that the two hands was the hands of my mother. We as a psychologist know that we have the influence of the mother in the first years of life, in the psychological development. And I always wonder, what is the role of the mother in the end of a life? What is the role they have there to comfort when it's time to go, to kind of to finish this little journey for this period of time. Then that's what the way I have been worked with this, sometimes have been very conflicting. Sometimes I used to go in my office, my God, where I am completely lost. I'm a lost soul that does not know which way to go. And then I started to see the only thing they make sense to me is to look at this just as a pathways for some direction. One is work with the comfort, you have to work with the end.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's very moving, thank you. I'm really established in this wonder of the immersion of the way this path works. And in the sense of being a visitor, being a guest on this land, is something that has made a lot of sense to me over my lifetime of travel and all the blah, blah. And coming and going from illness several times, near death, lots of that, has really opened a different sort of appreciation now of the simplicity that I'm hearing this path offering. And when I looked again, meeting in certain ways, this consistency of the pointedness of the simplicity, it really appeals to what I know I need to cultivate in this body, being a guest on this planet in this time and space. And so the addiction to the discursive thoughts and my intense creativity that has served me well is a light to others, but no longer a food for me. Mm-hmm. And so that polarity or that distinction-making process that this time in life requires, right, for furtherance, mm-hmm. Particularly in the commitments and cares that I'm now choosing more, with more discernment, I guess would be the way. I just also want to say that this land and those who came before, the stupas and all of the rituals and ceremonies that we continue to make battle with relative to our beliefs that aren't serving this more simple way of living, learning, working, and loving, really offer the structure for an essential ecological rehabilitation. And if that enters the systems that we're all living in, working in, providing service in, then that, if it's not a wish, then it's almost like the demand that I hear lying under the teachings, and that cultivation, that oxygenation of this furtherance really provides guidance in each in our own way with whatever is coming through us and is clearing from the DNA that continues to do violence. So this how do you find peace question that you offered really goes to a very specific thing that I can now focus on moving forward. We were Quakers, my family. One of my ancestors decided to fight and excommunicated. My brothers love the swords that they were able to wield in the Civil War. And so there's this family of origin that's kind of finding its way through the developmental process of the young ones coming up, meeting and greeting, and then setting aside those tendencies that came from decisions way back. And so the quality of the conversation at any level of context now, it's been spoken of here already, provides a deep lifting up of the tangled root that we might think is ours, right, this not self, and to freshen up the view without so much complexity, you know, about who am I and what am I supposed to do with my time. So I just wanted to say that I have a context that's a little more difficult than I ever really wanted to get into, because I didn't raise a family, and now it's like, oh, crap. Now it's like, uh-huh, Aunt Allie.
come on, get over here. So there's this, what role is this part of my life, you know, wanting to shift into nurturing something that might have, you know, some DNA influence on the ones who come after in this larger family, alongside of the other contexts that I have accepted responsibility in. But this choice, right, in this moment of the meditative, contemplative path in the more difficult places and spaces on the planet is what my heart is actually saying yes to in a way that in the past I would say, do I have to? You know, that kind of thing. So that putting down of that aversive nature, which that's been a real trip, is a lovely thing to be able to offer some relief to and reinstitute another part of my being that has a little more alignment with those vibratory capacities for the reverence of the all and everything and the remembrance that it does offer all of us for the future. So that quality of emergence is really that, what's the potential space that I'm still afraid of entering, right? That thing about staying upright in any context. So very grateful, very humbled. And I'm so glad we had the weather that we did, because it gives such a concrete, it freezes and then it warms up again. So thank you.
Yeah.
Very honored to be in your presence. Look forward to staying in touch.
Red. I think Chao wants to say something.
I just want to clarify one thing in my comment. I started to think it don't make it maybe too much sense in English. I was thinking Portuguese, try to express. When I talk about my mother hold my head, my mother is in Brazil. She's very old. I felt that really in the psychological and the mental aspect. Even I was talking about the role of the mother in the end of life, I also was thinking about these inner work models. The mother like a secure island, the refugee for a person is going. I mean, really not talk about the mother physically there. This man, I gave him the I got to die, my mother got to be there, my son's got to die, my wife got to be there. No, I really was in the, I hope that
I understand.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, I've got a tiny little something for you. It's been up here on the shrine. These are blessing strings. You might have seen something like this before. You can just pass the basket around and choose what you'd like. And if you want to take any extras for people in your life, you may certainly do that as well. It's really, you know, the tradition of blessing strings. Oftentimes you'll see the tradition of taking the ball or the I don't know what you'd call it the roll and it goes all the way around the room and everybody's encircled by it and then chanting blessings and then cutting the string and putting it around your wrist. And the idea really, I from my perspective, is, you know, thinking about something you want to recall or intend and using the bracelet as a way to remind you. Something you want to carry with you from this experience, perhaps. And There might be. I mean, some people think there's some protection in it. I think the protection is the determination of our own mind and our purification of our thoughts, words, and actions. I think that's the real protection. But maybe this can be an opportunity. So you might need some help, like opening it. You pull it apart and you stick your hand through it, and then you might need somebody to help close it again. I'm not sure, but see what goes on there. And then the next thing, after we all get them, I'm going to give you an opportunity to take the three refuges and the five precepts. Because if you took the eight precepts during this time, then five is the appropriate thing leaving, I imagine, except for those who keep doing eight precepts, which is also great. So the five precepts aren't exactly perfectly represented on those last pages of your handout, but it's close. And I'll lead you through number three in a five precept mode. Maybe while people are getting their bracelets, I'll read this poem to you. This is from the First Free Women's book by Maddie Weingast. It's the last poem in the book. And the story, this is a bhikkhuni named Sumedha. And she was the daughter of the chief queen of King Koryancha, something like that. And she became, I don't know how she heard the Buddhist teachings. Oh yeah, it says here that I was wearing a new white dress on the morning I first heard the Dhamma. I imagine it was from the Buddha, but I'm not sure. But she really took it up, picked it up, and she was very learned, and she was very articulate, this princess. And she asked her parents if they would give her permission to become a bhikkhuni, and they didn't want to give her permission. And well, I'll read this. I don't know if there's, basically they had already arranged her marriage with a king, this is not exactly how it went. She gave them an incredibly strident Dhamma talk and was then released from the plan and able to become a nun. Sumedha, it means wisdom, great wisdom. I was wearing a new white dress on the morning I first heard the Dharma. Something was calling, but I couldn't quite make it out. I started spending more and more time alone in my room. One morning after breakfast, my mother asked me what was going on, so I told her. The Buddha's path isn't easy to follow, my mother said, especially for someone accustomed to getting whatever she wants. Marry the good king, Anikadatta. Enjoy all the things young ladies enjoy, dressing up, being waited on, and going to expensive parties like weddings. Today you want to dress this body up and sell it at a wedding, I told her. But soon enough, they'll be selling it at the graveyard for nothing. We are cows chasing the axe. We are soft flesh chasing the cobra's fangs. We are dry straw chasing the torch. We are lovers chasing our own reflections. Mother, we are walking food. The vultures circle, we lie down, and the feast begins. My parents watched as I took a long, sharp knife and cut off my long black hair. Just then, King Anikadata walked in. He looked at me, blade in one hand, a couple of feet of hair in the other. Then he smiled. With your hair cut short, Sumedha, you look even more beautiful. Soon all the women in our kingdom will be cutting their hair just like yours. Come, my love, the whole world is chasing happiness. You and I will be among the lucky few who win the race. Good king, I said, if we spend our lives running after the things of the world, we will die and keep right on running. Stealing the things we mean to earn, setting fire to the things we mean to protect, drowning the people we mean to love, and turning into enemies those most like ourselves. I threw my hair to the ground. Anikadata knelt down, picked up a few strands, and then let them fall. Then he stood and turned to my parents. You who would have been my mother, you who would have been my father, let Sumedha go. May she find the path, and may she one day return to show us all the way home. It's getting dark now, my sisters. The sun's going down, and soon we'll all be going our separate ways. Can we sit here together just a little while longer, not saying anything at all? The path will go on, rising and falling like a song. And in the end, you will find yourself as one lost at sea finds herself, finally washed ashore. Listen. Can you hear that? The sound of the wind in the leaves, like a wave coming on. Go on. Shake up the world. Set yourself free. You ready for the precepts? Does everybody have their bracelet? Not quite, almost? Okay. Give it a little more time. I want to say that I very much
thank you for helping everyone.
It's okay, Suzanne.
I just came to help him with his bracelet.
Oh.
I forgot that I had attached to this thing.
Got it. I think everybody's had it. They're good. I think everything is coming together over here. Thank you all. You found your glasses, though.
I did.
Great.
Yes. Nothing ever really disappears for long. Until it does.
Okay. I just wanted to say again that I've really appreciated everyone's sharing, and I might have mentioned yesterday, I'm planning to have my meal with you today, and hope we can touch base a little bit. And we'll do the refuges and precepts and a little more blessing chanting, and then we'll call it a retreat.
May I ask you the last question?
Sure, of course.
What is the meaning of your name?
Oh,
How do you say it?
How do you say it? Santusika. Santusika. And well, someone yesterday, I think it was Molly, asked me what is the word for peace, and I said pasadi is pretty good, but actually that's much more tranquility. But Santi, the beginning of my name, is peace. Santusika actually means contentment.
Means what?
Contentment. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Angel. Yeah, you're welcome.
May I?
Yes.
Offer an arising that came this morning.
Do you want a microphone for that?
The microphone is dead.
Okay, so, never mind. Go for it. The arising.
That's even better. Because what drew me was poem and dhamma. Before, I'm going to sing.
Okay.
Between the B and D, the C of it. Between the birth and death. The choice of it. Between the blizzard, earthquake, and eclipse, the sutta gives this voice.
Thank you, Molly. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dhammang saranang gacchami. Sanghang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Panatipata veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Panatipata veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Altogether, I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. Adina dana veratmani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. Now you're going to have to listen to this one. Kamesu. Michachara.
Michachara.
Veratmani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. Musawada veratmani. Sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from false and harmful speech. Suramiraya. Maja. Pamadatana. Veratmani. Sikapadang samadhiyami.
Sikapadang samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to carelessness. These are the five precepts. Virtue is the source of happiness. Virtue is the source of true wealth. Virtue is the source of peacefulness. Therefore, let virtue be purified. Yes. Now let's chant the sharing of blessings on page 4. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest devas and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind until I realize Nibbana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. May you have every good blessing. May all the devas protect you. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you ever be well. May you have every good blessing. May all the devas protect you by the power of all the Dhamma. May you ever be well. May you have every good blessing. May all the devas protect you by the power of all the Sangha. May you ever be well. Okay, my friends. Happy journeys. As you know, I'll be around a little while, so welcome to whatever within the precepts. Okay. Oh, sure. That's a good idea, Molly.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.